Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage? Shopify's there to help you grow. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/marketplace, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/marketplace now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/marketplace.
1,100 pages, 4,600 recipes, arguably the grandmother of all cookbooks on the program today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, November the 11th. Good as always to have you here, everybody. Quick thing right at the outset to make sure you all are up to speed. Big week on Capitol Hill this week. As you know, Wednesday, some key testimony is coming. Jay Powell, of course, a doubleheader Wednesday and Thursday, the chairman of the Federal Reserve on the state of the American economy. You were thinking maybe of another hearing? Anyway, to actually get going today, this from the New York State Department of Financial Services. It's investigating whether the Apple Card, backed, as you might know, by Goldman Sachs, discriminates against women. That after a weekend Twitter tempest in which a tech entrepreneur complained that his wife was given a much lower credit limit than he was, even though her credit score was better than his, and they share assets. Another person who complained about the same thing, this from the Irony Department, the co-founder of Apple, Steve Wozniak. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore has the nuts and bolts of how all of this stuff gets decided.
How much money is your credit card going to let you borrow?
The biggest factor here is going to be your credit report.
Jill Gonzalez is an analyst with WalletHub.
That's obviously where the largest wealth of information on you is. Things like how on time you are when paying your bill, how long, the length of your credit history.
How much do you owe? How much do you make? That's all the standard stuff. But then there's a whole other layer of information that can be used. How long does the bank or credit card think you're going to stick with them? Are you brand loyal?
Apple obviously has lots of information about a lot of people.
Jonathan Glowacki is a principal at Milliman, a quantitative consulting firm for the financial industry. But the exact recipe? We don't know. It's a secret sauce for every credit card issuer, and it can change. The fact that we have to guess what exactly is going on, that's part of the reason why the New York Department of Financial Services is investigating. Linda A. Lacewell is New York Superintendent of Financial Services.
This is what's known as a black box, where there's no visibility into how these credit decisions are being made. And when consumers are applying for financial services and products, they're entitled as a matter of consumer protection to understand how these decisions are being made.
In a statement, Goldman says it bases credit limits on individual factors, so two members of the same family might get very different numbers. It also said it does not take gender into account when setting credit limits. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore from Marketplace.
This week in, wow, I didn't see that coming, Amtrak and its financials. The federally subsidized railway says it just wrapped up the best fiscal year in its history. Ridership hit a record 32.5 million trips. Revenue was up more than 3% compared to last year. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has been working on the railroad.
Amtrak has been steadily improving its numbers over the last decade or so. And now the company says it's on a solid path to breaking even. It's a change for the railway, which has long drawn the ire of Congress for big losses. Robert Puentes runs the Eno Center for Transportation. He says Amtrak has been investing heavily in the basics.
Making sure that trains are running on time, that stations are clean, that trains are clean, and just doing those things that would make the railroad competitive against other modes of transportation.
This is the last call for Amtrak.
Most of the ridership growth has been in Amtrak's already popular Northeast Corridor, but other routes are gaining popularity as well. Sarah Sanders recently took the train from Fayetteville, North Carolina, to New York's Penn Station.
In terms of flying versus train, the time, being able to leave at midnight and everything, sleep all the way through and not really waste your day, and then it was a lot cheaper as well.
I think more and more the traveling public is looking for options for trips that they have to take. air service is certainly problematic. We've lost a great deal of our intercity bus service in this country.
John Robert Smith is with the advocacy group Transportation for America. Amtrak's president and CEO, former Delta Airlines executive Richard Anderson, is digging in on shorter trips in particular, attempting to convince Americans that if you're only going a couple hundred miles, a train is a viable option to get you there. And it seems to be working. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Also on the economic calendar this week, by the way, in addition to Jay Powell Wednesday and Thursday, one Donald J. Trump speaking at the Economic Club of New York tomorrow. Usually there's question and answer after those speeches. We'll see what happens Tuesday. Wall Street on a Monday, tepid, I'd say. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. A year after the Camp Fire that killed 85 people and destroyed more than 13,000 homes in and around Paradise, California, that community is trying to rebuild. It's daunting, but the locals are driven. The big question is who is going to rebuild? From KQED, Sonia Hudson has more.
Dave and Christine Williams have lived in Butte County for most of their lives, and their roots run deep.
My grandfather's very first born of my family in this county, his first name was Butte, and he was born in 1888. My father's middle name was Butte, and I'm not a Butte, but anyway.
Their home survived the fire. It's their history that's driving them to help the town rebuild. They recently bought two empty lots, like this one.
These are half-acre lots that at one time had, well, before the fire, three-bedroom, two-bath, single-family homes.
Driving around Paradise, you see lots of vacant lots these days. There's a lot of rebuilding to do. But the Williams have faith the town will come back. Here's Christine.
It's a beautiful town. It's a beautiful place to live. Great place to raise families.
In the days and weeks after the fire, residents were worried that big developers would swoop in, buy up the land for cheap, and rebuild Paradise in a way that would alter the existing community. And roughly 30% of the properties sold after the campfire went for less than their assessed value. But KQED found in an analysis of property sales and building permits from the day the fire hit to September of this year, most sales didn't go to out-of-town investors. Of the parcels that changed hands in the town of Paradise, 71% were bought by someone with a Butte County mailing address, like the Williams.
We're just hoping to encourage people to come on back.
In Santa Rosa, things turned out differently in the aftermath of the 2017 North Bay fires. Some big developers from the Greater Bay Area and as far away as L.A. did buy up properties there. Greg Owen is one of those developers. His company, Silvermark Luxury Homes, based in Fairfield, bought 100 properties in Santa Rosa neighborhoods burned by fires there. Owen says he thought about buying lots in Paradise, but after visiting a couple times, decided it wasn't a good investment because a lot of the infrastructure was lost.
The hospitals were gone. Most of the homes were on septic, and they also had a problem getting water.
Developer Luigi Balsamo, who lives in nearby Chico, bought 4 lots in Paradise. He's ready to start rebuilding now and has confidence in the community.
There's a lot of group meetings and town halls and things going on here that I say, like, to keep your finger on the pulse. But I think also it's kind of a feeling up here. I mean, I get the feeling like I believe in Paradise. I want to see it come back.
Balsamo says while he does stand to profit from these purchases, he also wants to help the town stay affordable for the low-income people who used to live there. One way he's doing that, using less expensive prefab manufactured homes that run about $75,000 for a 1,500-square-foot home. Despite the difficulties facing the town, locals like Dave Williams says the financial uncertainty that comes with buying land in a burn area is worth it to him to make sure people return to the area.
We want to make sure this is a good place for families to be, and if we can just do our little contribution, and I'm not saying we're going to do it for free, but if we can just do it to where I'll sleep better at night knowing that we helped a little bit.
The median price for a home in Paradise is around $420,000, according to the online real estate company Zillow. That's just about what it was a year ago, before the campfire. I'm Sonia Hudson for Marketplace.
Sonia's story was also reported by KQED's Michelle Wiley and Lisa Pickoff-White. On this Veterans Day, about which, full disclosure, I am one, an interview now about the Army's new ad campaign aimed at a generation not generally familiar with military service. The Army is hoping the What's Your Warrior campaign is going to resonate with Generation Z by focusing on high-tech and highly skilled careers. Last year, for the first time in more than a decade, the Army missed its recruiting goals, which is germane here. Brigadier General Alex Fink runs the brand new Army Marketing Enterprise team. General Fink, welcome to the program, sir.
Glad to be here, Kai.
I think people will be surprised to hear that the Army has a marketing organization. Why do you need it?
Well, we have a requirement to bring in new people every year and competing for the youth. And that's what this campaign's about, is competing for that Gen Z population. Right. In a great economy like we have right now, it takes an organization and a lot of effort to ensure that we keep the Army in their consideration set as they make decisions about their careers.
Well, let's walk through some of those challenges. You certainly alluded to one, a really good economy. We're almost at full employment. Gen Z and those younger folks in this economy, my guess would be, don't have a real thorough understanding of the military, probably not a lot of direct contact experience. And oh, by the way, we've been at war for 18 years. And how do you convince people to go shoot guns and drive tanks?
Right. We don't have a reverence issue. We have a relevance issue. Research shows that 50% of youth know little or nothing about military service, and that's just because fewer people are around anybody that has served. And so, you know, here walking down the streets in Chicago, I'll have numerous people thank mm-hmm. me for my service, yet they don't necessarily see it as relevant to what they would do or what they would tell their children.
Well, so let's get into that divide a little bit, if we could. And this is going to get you into some dicey territory because, in theory, somebody with more stars than you on their shoulders is going to listen to this. but I will point out here, as I said in the introduction, I'm a veteran, and I have people from time to time thank me for my service. And I wonder if, in this society today, the challenge of the civilian-military divide has not become that reverence thing where you are thanked for your service, but people don't necessarily want to do it.
You're right. What we haven't done in the Army is tell the whole story. And the stories we have told maybe reinforce some perceptions that they have, that everybody has to be able to jump out of a Black Hawk on a fast rope and right. be ready for direct action. And the reality is we do that, and we'll showcase that, but that's not the only thing we do. We have over 150 opportunities for careers in the United States Army that we think the Gen Z population, they want to do, but and they can do that in the context of Army service.
So tell me how they can do it, right? This new campaign you've got, it's called What's Your Warrior? Big data comes into play. You guys are going like video games and younger audiences. Tell me how you're going to do it tactically.
So we have to stop their thumbs, right? We have to have a thumb-stopping yeah. experience yeah. for them. They've made Olympic sport out of thumbing through social media. So we've got to do it. We've got to surprise them. And it builds on this immersive, epic storytelling properties that have influenced their world to gain their attention. You know, speak to them on their terms, in their language. And so we'll be in the digital channels for sure, across online video, social, streaming audio, but also television. We still see television as an important place to be as well.
So this is a little bit big picture, and I hate to end on a downer, but talk to me about the risk if this doesn't work, because we still do have national security obligations. The Army is a key part of those, and you guys are having a tough time making your numbers.
So the campaign and the beauty of operating in a digital marketing realm affords us the opportunity to adjust fire as we go through. So we'll be able to determine very quickly the effects that we're having, the ads that are working, those that aren't working as well, where they're working, and we can, you know, make decisions about what we do next. Mm-hmm. So we have a lot of faith in this campaign. We think that we've got something that's going to resonate and work. But we also recognize that things don't always go according to plan. And so we've also built in contingencies.
It's that whole thing about no plan surviving first contact with the enemy, as it were, right?
Exactly. Yeah. A very similar approach. And in fact, quite frankly, that logic and that idea is how we sold this campaign to Army senior leaders, is that ability to make adjustments in stride.
Brigadier General Alex Fink. He runs the Army Enterprise Marketing Team based now in Chicago. General Fink, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up.
More garlic.
More garlic.
Always more garlic.
I mean, they're not wrong, you know? Updating a classic, but first, let's do the numbers. Seriously, always more garlic. Dow Industrial's up 10 points today, less than a 10%, 26,691. NASDAQ down 11, that's a 10% there as well, 84.64. S&P 500 lost 6 points, also a 10%, 3,087. Walgreens Boots Alliance jumped 5% today and reports the private equity group KKR had formally approached the drugstore giant for what could be the biggest ever leveraged buyout. So, you know, we'll see how that goes. Boeing up 4.5% today. The plane maker said it expects to resume deliveries of the 737 MAX as early as next month. In other news, the Federal Aviation Administration said its officials have no time frame for when their review of that airplane is going to be complete. Boeing's European rival Airbus dipped less than a 10%. Today you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There's a little bit of history that goes along with this next interview. History that dates to 1931, when Irma Rombauer published a cookbook called The Joy of Cooking. It became, not to hyperbolize here, but a really big deal. Conversational, easy to use. It was the cookbook to have in your kitchen. Irma and her daughter, Marion Rombauer Becker, revised it and updated it. 8 revisions in all, and now 9 with the 2019 edition. Again, a family affair. John Becker and his wife, Megan Scott, did the heavy lifting. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, pleasure to be here.
I suppose I need to do the genealogy first, right, John? Who are you to Irma Rombauer, the matriarch, I guess, of this entire enterprise?
Great-grandson. So, okay. Yeah, fourth generation of the family to take on the mantle of the joy of cooking.
Well, so we will get back to that in a minute. And Megan, you are married to John, and you guys worked on this together, yes?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. I will let either of you answer this. And bear in mind that other members of your family are probably going to hear it. How heavy is the burden of being in charge of the most recent edition of this cookbook?
Oh, it's incredibly heavy. I mean, you know, every day, just the mantra was, don't mess up today.
And I don't think that pressure was coming so much from John's family as much as it was just from us not wanting to mess up something that has such a rich history and so many people love.
It's an icon, but it's also the family business, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay. Now, why do we need a new one?
Oh, let me count the ways. I don't know. I mean, with any new edition, our mission as a family business is to just make it better, to make it more complete, to make it more relevant for readers today. Whether that's, you know, elaborating on a technique that we felt needed to be a little bit more fleshed out or adding a recipe for beef rendang or, you know, just it really runs the gamut. A lot of people think that the book is monolithic, that it doesn't change. You know, even on Twitter the other day, somebody was like, you know, yeah, my edition doesn't have shrimp scampi. It's like, oh, well, that's been in the book since, you know, the 1997 edition.
buy a new copy, pal. Buy a new copy.
yes.
Megan, what was the methodology? Because this thing is, sorry, just flipping through it. At the end of the index, it's at least 1,100 pages long. How does one go about revising and extending this thing?
Well, we've been doing it slowly over the past 10 years or so. In that time, we also did these recipe genealogies where we would figure out where a recipe was added in the history of the book and figure out how it had changed. And then we kind of moved more into working on this current edition. So every sentence of every section of every chapter was thoroughly reviewed, and we made notes of everything we wanted to change or fact check or add. Anything we felt could make the book better, we made note of. And then that's when we actually started revising the book.
Did you all like test all the 4,500 or whatever it is recipes in this book?
Yes, we did.
No, did you really?
This is actually all in-house, yeah. This is the first edition since the 70s where the family has really taken on the burden of testing everything and doing all of the research ourselves. Of course, time was running short at a certain point, and then we had some trusted friends, you know, help test some of the recipes where we were less concerned about. Yeah. But all of it was done in home kitchens. So yeah, definitely quite the undertaking.
So let me ask you a syntax question, which astute listeners to this program may or may not pay attention to. As I do with every interview, before we actually get going, I said, tell me who you are and how you want to be identified. And John, you said, I'm John Becker, yada, yada, blah, 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 the latest edition of The Joy of Cooking. And your wife said, I'm Megan Scott, yada, yada, blah, 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 the latest edition of Joy of Cooking. There's an article issue here. Is it The Joy of Cooking or Joy of Cooking?
You know, it's, I think on the cover of the book, it's been identified without the.
Yeah, Joy of Cooking. I think this was a Jeopardy question at some point that someone got wrong and then they got mad at us.
No, I think it changed that. I think it was the 1960s where the cover no longer had the included.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah.
I just had to get that out. Okay, so look, so I'm flipping through this thing, and we got a lot of cookbooks here. Obviously, don't talk about too many of them, but all of them that are coming in have pictures of food and great illustrations, and you can just flip through them and look and say, oh, that looks really good to eat. This does not. This is throwback is the word, right? There's drawings, and that's about it. Do you guys see that as a competitive disadvantage, or what's the play there?
Well, in a certain way, of course, it's a disadvantage, especially for, you know, a readership that is used to seeing pictures and getting the idea of what a dish is supposed to look like. On the other hand, it's a little bit, you know, liberating to know that you're not necessarily comparing your results with those of something that's been professionally styled and lit. But yeah, that actually goes back to the 1950s. Marion and Irma both fought tooth and nail to keep photography out of The Joy of Cooking because they felt like it was going to date it. And if you look at the photography from
the 50s,
from those eras, sure, they actually had a pretty good rationale, it turns out.
Interesting. Okay, so I get that this is probably like asking your favorite child, or maybe I'm reading too much into it. Do you have a favorite recipe in this book, either of you two?
Everyone asks that question.
All right, you're sick and tired of
it? There's so many.
It's
hard to choose, and we like different ones for different reasons, but the one that I've been telling people that I love so much is the olive oil cake.
Oh, those are good. I've had those.
Yeah,
I mean,
fantastic.
Maybe not this one, but I really like olive oil cakes.
Yeah,
this one
has orange zest and juice. It's really, really delicious.
All right, John, you got a favorite? Yeah. Or you're just going to go with maybe?
I'm going to go with the olive oil cake for sure. But I mean, we've typically just been answering with the last thing we cooked, and so we had kimchi fried rice for breakfast the other day, and that was fantastic.
So you mentioned kimchi fried rice in Joy of Cooking, not The Joy of Cooking, by the way. prompts this question: what do you suppose great-grandma Irma would say about kimchi fried rice being in the latest edition of her cookbook?
I don't know. I think that Irma was definitely like an adventurous cook, and she definitely likes, you know, kind of interesting flavor combinations. So I think that she would appreciate it. But Marion, on the other hand,
her daughter, yeah,
according to my dad, the best compliment she could give a dish is that it was delicately flavored. And so I think that she would be kind of blown away by not only the kimchi fried rice, but also a lot of the other recipes that we've added, because we really have kind of tried to, you know, up the spice level and call for, you know, funkier ingredients and
more garlic.
Oh,
always more garlic.
Always. John Becker and Megan Scott, the latest generation of the Joy of Cooking Enterprise. It's the latest edition 2019. Thanks, you two. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
It was a pleasure.
That whole idea of recipe genealogies that Megan was talking about, by the way, sounded kind of interesting to us. So we put the evolution of Joy of Cooking's pumpkin pie recipe on our website. Take a look. Let us know what you think. Marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, which may signal that we have reached peak podcast. CNN reports today that Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's personal lawyer and himself right at the bullseye of the Ukraine impeachment inquiry, was overheard in public the other day talking about launching an impeachment podcast. A Giuliani spokeswoman confirmed the conversation and said, quote, many Americans want to hear directly from Rudy Giuliani. I'll add the tag here, which will come to nobody's surprise. Available wherever you get your podcasts. Okay, we got to go. Flat all over the place on Wall Street today. Bond market closed, by the way, for the Veterans Day holiday. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Andy Corbin, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Bennett Purser. Eliza Mills is our special projects producer. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.